And good morning. It's Wednesday, 10 a.m. You are tuned to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai and Soldotna. And maybe you remember that tune. It's time once again for the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Shaylin Cochran. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And a very fun program that we like to do when we have an opportunity here at KDLL. It's time once again. Maybe you've noticed the weather is getting a bit nicer out there. Well, maybe not so much today, but usually it's been getting pretty nice. And if you're of a certain interest, well, there's a lot of fun sounds, a lot of fun sights going on right now. It's almost time for the Kenai Birding Festival, that kicking off. And we've got a couple of guys in studio that are a big part of the Kenai Birding Festival each year. We've got Ken Tarbox and Toby Burke with us this morning. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being in the studio. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And want to get started off. We would love to have anyone out there who is interested in what's going on this weekend. If you've been out birding, if you have questions about what's going on this week, please feel free to give us a call anytime throughout the next hour. 907-690-1687. Again, that's 690-1687. Give us a call. Jump in on this conversation. And I want to get started by just kind of a rundown. Ken, we'll start with you, of just kind of what's going on. I know the Peeps Art Show is on display and things are really getting kicked off. Tell us what's going on this week.
Oh, we're having a good time so far. So right now, this is our 13th festival, and that is really exciting for everybody to realize it's gone on this long. It's all done with volunteers and very little funds, less than $1,000 to put the festival on.
Wow.
And it's free to everybody. This week on Monday, we hung the Peeps Art Show. We have a little over 30 entries from kids, and they're fantastic. And they're at the Kenai Chamber of Commerce and Visitor Center, and they'll be up through Saturday. So we encourage everybody to go in and take a look at them. Tomorrow we kick off with the actual field events and the real festival. First thing in the morning, we have the float trip down the Kenai River. That's been booked, and we have the Kenai River Professional Guide Association provides the guides. Kenai Bird Club provides the bird guides, and it's just a great day. I think Toby can probably talk about more of that later. But
sure.
And then also tomorrow at 8 o'clock up at the Kenai Wildlife Refuge headquarters, we have our first bird walk. So that starts things. Thursday night, we have the orientation for the festival for people that are new or just want to, you know, get a heads up on what's going to happen over the next few days. And then we're going to play a bird trivia game, which we've never done before.
That sounded new. Yeah, I thought it was a new feature this year.
It is, and we're not sure how it's going to go, but, you know, bird trivia is fun. I can guarantee you they're not really hard questions, but we're going to let people form teams, and or we'll help them form teams, and we're going to have five or six rounds of 10 questions each, and there'll be prizes for the winning team. Of course, at all of our evening events, we have a number of door prizes, so you know, you always have a chance of winning something. On Friday, we have again a number of bird walks, and in the afternoon we have what's called the hotspot tours at Kasilof and Kenai. And we also have a float trip going down the Kasilof River.
Yeah.
So that's Friday events. Saturday, we start off with the big sit, more bird walks around the area. I mean, we go all the way from the North Peninsula recreational area to Moose River. So you have to get on the schedules or pick up a schedule at the visitor center to find out. The other place you can go to is the website of the Kenai Peninsula Tourism and Marketing Council. So that's www.kenaipeninsula.org. And then you go to Events Bird Fest, and the schedule's right there with maps on how to get to places.
Right.
So, and then Sunday we end it with a barbecue out at Marlow's on the Kenai. Again, it's free. You know, bring whatever you want. We tell people that are out of state and they maybe are in hotels and stuff that get worried about a potluck, and we provide the meat. And so, you know, bring a bag of chips. We really want you to come. We don't really care what you bring. We usually have lots of food.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a summary real quick of of the events without getting into the details of every walk and everything.
Sure, and we'll revisit those before we end the program a little bit later. But I wanted to, the 13th year of this, and I'm really interested in how this has sort of grown over the years, because as a lot of folks know, birding is becoming more and more popular. A lot of folks are recognizing how much fun it can be to just spend some time outdoors and recognize these things and observe these things. And it's not just birds when you're out there. There's all sorts of stuff to really kind of sink your eyes and your ears and your mind into. How has it grown, and what do they look forward to when they come from all over the state and all over the country too?
Right. We have a number of visitors coming from out of state now. Well, when the festival started back in 2005, it was actually Todd Esklin and Jocelyn O'Connors who started the initial festival. And the idea was just to provide some expertise for people who wanted to get into birding locally here. We probably had 30 people at the festival. I mean, now we have 300 or so participating. We didn't have the Peeps Art Show. That's been added. We didn't have the number of walks that we have. We have those now. And I think what festivals do, besides making awareness of the outdoors and the fun you can have in birding, it's a social event too. People get together, they get a chance to talk about their birding experiences in the past year. They share stories from other areas. I've gone to a number of them and had people tell me, well, you ought to visit this site, or, you know, this place isn't on the map, but here's where you should go to find this bird, especially for those that are making life lists and looking for rare birds. So it's a combination of things as to why people go to festivals, but it is a social event. The other thing is, it's a learning event. We have a number of experts that are at the festival, and they are there to help people. And we encourage families and kids to come to our festival. That's one of the things that we like to take pride in, is we want new birders. We want young kids to come in. We want them to enjoy looking at birds. And so I guess I tell everybody that's coming to the festival, don't be afraid to ask questions, because we're there to help you. And don't be intimidated by the fact that we have a world-class birder in Lynn Barber coming. And, you know, when she's out in the field and she's telling you every bird, or Bev Kirsch is telling you this bird's singing and she can hear it 100 yards away and I can't hear it 10 yards away. You know, don't get intimidated. Just accept it and say, hey, how did you know that? Or what did you see that keyed you into that song, okay?
Yeah, there really are tons of learning opportunities. You know, since I've been here, I've had an opportunity to go on some of these walks. And I remember a couple of years ago going for a walk through around Funny River, where the fire had just burned either the year previous or 2 years previous. I don't remember which. But that was such an interesting experience. There were so many people there who were so interested in precisely that kind of scene that is, you know, you don't get to see freshly burned through areas and what that kind of provides for birds. And so I guess, Toby, maybe I'll ask you this. You've been out and about a little bit. What are we seeing this time of year? Are a lot of shorebirds? Are we seeing, you know, what's going on out there?
We have our water birds. We have, of course, you know, spring migration. Usually it's beginning with waterfowl, you know, the ducks and the geese, and then it kind of proceeds to, you know, we're getting gulls and shorebirds. And then kind of lastly, you know, we're getting the passerines, the small perching birds, the songbirds. And so, like I said, we're to the stage now where the passerines, they're now coming. And it's not that we're getting each in isolation, as one is being added to the other. So we're getting our bigger and bigger and bigger complement of our breeding birds, in addition to some of the migrants that will leave here but are still hanging on. So we have May is a nice month here, like I said, as far as having our breeding birds and, like I said, the migrants that are still lingering.
Right. I'm curious, again, you know, kind of thinking about some of my own experience, limited though it is, and watching breeding pairs, that's, if you have the time and I guess the interest too, watching a breeding pair just sort of interact for a while, that can be really fascinating. And I'm curious for both of you, what is it about being able to observe these creatures in their habitat? What is it about that that's so appealing or so interesting? Toby?
I think, you know, the one thing is sometimes there's the pageantry, like with sandhill cranes, watching their dance and the jumping, and I think a lot of times, you know, people feel like they're getting this glimpse of wildness that you know, that to some extent, you know, we don't generally have in our lives. You know, we, a lot of us work inside four walls, and our glimpse of the wild, wild Alaska is really just through a window. So when we get outdoors and we see wildlife interacting in its natural habitat, I think we're kind of, you know, there's that connection with our deeper, more primitive self, maybe.
Yeah. And Ken, you spend so much time helping other folks enjoy. What's still out there for you?
Well, there's a couple of things that come to mind. First off, there's birders, so you can break them into a couple of categories. I mean, you can have those that make life list, and that's the sense of the hunt. I mean,
oh, yeah.
They're hunting in a non-consumptive way and enjoying it, but really what they're doing is when you're chasing a rare bird or something, you're going, I'm going to go find that out there. So there's that sense of the hunt with people who list birds, and just the thrill of making a list and seeing how many you can see, kind of the competition part of it. Then there's the behavior part of it, which is what you're talking about, where you can sit for a half hour and watch a pair of Arctic terns where the male is feeding the female to gain her favors, right? And it's just funny. I mean,
oh, yeah.
There's humor in the outdoors. So it's fun to watch them just from a humorous viewpoint. And I watched that the other day with a male trying to feed a female. And he kept bringing her fish, and she'd take it and drop it and kind of rejected him. And you could see he was getting frustrated with this. And they were squawking and making all types of noise. And then we watched a pair of gulls the other day try to breed. And again, the female was not ready, and the male was just going crazy. So you kind of relate it back to your own life sometimes. So anyway, it's just the behavior, the ecology. We look at, for example, down in the flats, the caribou are right there now and calving. Moose are going to be calving. We try to tie it together in the bird festival that it's not a single species or a single entity. It's really an ecological system that's functioning out there. And we want people to appreciate and understand that.
Yeah, and that's something that that we'll want to speak about a little bit more in depth as the program continues. We're talking about birding today, the Kenai Birding Festival underway this week. A lot of stuff going on, a lot of the bigger events beginning tomorrow evening. The Peeps Art Show is up at the Kenai Visitor Center. Be sure to check that out. But tons of events throughout the weekend coming up. And remind us of the website again, Ken.
It's www.kenaipeninsula.org, and then you go to the events page, and then under Bird Fest, and there's all types of resources there. There's maps, the festival schedule, and of course at the visitor center late this afternoon we'll have an information nest table set up so people can stop in and pick up a schedule if they want to, or maps,
and get those plans made for the weekend. And if you have any questions, if you have some birding stories, if you've been out this year and have seen something interesting, if you're starting to check things off of that life list, hey, give us a call. We'd love to have you in on the conversation this morning. 690-1687 is the number. Again, 690-1687. Ken and I were going back and forth on email setting this show up, and I asked him, you know, give me a few birds that we could listen to, that we could actually maybe put a name to the sound that we hear so often. And it was, you know, I spend a little bit of time outdoors, and it's that idea that you hear all these things all the time, but actually taking the time to stop and remember it and put a sort of a name to a face kind of a thing. We don't always take time to do that. And I thought maybe we could take a few seconds here during this program to do that. And you sent me several suggestions of some different species, and most of them, some of them are pretty common. And we're going to start off with this one. I think everybody will recognize this. That's a pretty easy one, right? Quiz time. All right. What was that one?
American Robin.
American Robin, yeah.
Singing.
And that's something, too, I have. Let me back this recording up just a little bit. There are different parts to the calls, right? They're conveying different things, and that's an interesting part of it, too. So that, I'll play this again. What we just heard was the call, correct?
That was just the song.
Okay. That was the song. All right. Let's listen to this whole thing here.
Now that would be a call.
And that would be the call. And so there's a lot of dynamics, and there's so much to think about within just a few seconds of hearing these birds talk to one another. And how long have you been doing this, Toby, that you're able to sort of store this? It seems like it would take up a lot of RAM space in your head, but it's over time it just kind of It's in there, huh?
Right, right. After a while, it's just a part of life. But for me, it's been like maybe since I was around 20, so 30 plus years.
Yeah.
But a lot of times what we're identifying when we talk about, you know, bird song, we're talking about their nuptial song, the song that they attract a mate. And also, it's this, also the same song that also declares a territory. One, like I said, attract a, you know, a female, or two, to repel other males. We're saying this area is taken, stay away, you know.
So will you be, when you're out birding and you're looking for something specific, are you looking for a certain song or call or something like that, depending on the time of the month or the time of the year or the conditions that you're in? Does it change what you're looking for depending on where you're at and when you're there?
Oh, sure. Of course, you know, we're always taking into account habitat, you know, birds that are likely to be in that area, whether they're breeding or passing through. You know, like I said, when we talk about migrants, a lot of times they're not necessarily singing, but they might be calling as they move through an area, even an area that they may not breed in. They might, like I said, be moving through. But like I said, you know, so much of birding is serendipity, is we're hoping for something that we really didn't expect, you know.
Yeah, yeah, the surprise is where it's at.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's try another one here, see if we, I'm sure both of you will be quite familiar with this. That's a pretty common sound around here, right?
Yes, yes. That's a red-breasted nuthatch.
Yeah, all right. See, it's you're primed and ready for this trivia thing coming up, aren't you? I can tell already.
But, you know, interesting about the red-breasted nuthatch
is
the red-breasted nuthatch is a relative newcomer to our area. It's really a temperate breeder. And prior to the 1970s, it didn't breed up here. So it's a newcomer.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wanted to get into that eventually, and now is as good a time as any. I'm curious, over the years, and you guys have both spent a lot of years out in the woods and observing things, and I'm curious, what has changed? Are there different breeds? Are there species that we're seeing here that we didn't see before, like the red-breasted nuthatch, or are there species that we used to see that we don't see anymore? What's going on?
Well, we're definitely getting more temperate breeders that are making it further north. Like I said, you know, we mentioned red-breasted nuthatch, and also brown creeper. Those are relatively, basically I'm saying like this generation now that sees it as a common bird, a previous generation that was kind of conscious of this would say, hey, you know, they were not common birds. They were not breeders. You know, they were newcomers. But there's quite a few. I mean, even just some people may be aware, like crows, longtime residents that, you know, crows are really a northwestern crow. They may have seen them down in Homer and Catchmack Bay, but they're only the last 15 years have they been up toward us and actually breeding. Stellar's Jay is also another one of those. And for longtime residents like Ken, you know, he's probably been here where he remembers when they weren't here, and now he remembers when they are, you know.
Thanks, yeah. Toby.
You know, I want to ask you guys about this because it just struck me. I'd forgotten about it for years. I was in Homer once and eating at a restaurant and looked out the window and I saw a pheasant, it was when I first moved to Alaska, and it struck me as a bit odd. I'm from Iowa, where that's not particularly odd to see pheasants running around. They're quite tasty. We see them all the time. But I felt like that was a little strange to see one in Homer. Pheasants on the peninsula? Just for my own curiosity.
They were probably brought up,
okay,
and then released or got out of their cages. And in Homer, it appears that they are breeding down there from what we can tell.
Interesting.
But like I had a northern bobwhite in my neighborhood. I could hear it calling and making this racket. And I went, wow, we got a northern bobwhite in Alaska. And then I realized my neighbors had his coop, and they all gotten out and got into my yard. So that happens.
That does happen from time to time. 6901687 is the number if you'd like to get in on this conversation. And it looks like we've got a call right now. Good morning. You're on the conversation. Who's this? Hello. You're on the conversation.
Hey. Yeah, I had a question for the fellows there.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. It was the area that I live out here on Coho. I used to see a lot of three-toed woodpeckers out here, really a lot of woodpeckers in general. And then, like a lot of folks, I went through and tried to take out all of the beetle kill to try to make things safer, you know, just if there was a wildfire or anything. But then a few weeks ago, I was watching a show on nature, and it was saying that, you know, the beetle kill is like the primary source of food for the woodpeckers, And I will say, since I took out that beetle kill, I haven't seen any woodpeckers, and I haven't seen a three-toed in years. And so I was just wondering if you knew anything about their numbers on the peninsula. And, I mean, if so, is there something I could do to help them out again? Because now I kind of feel bad that I sort of took out their food source. So, yeah, what could you tell me about the three-toeds?
Toby, we'll let you take that one. Thanks for the call.
Sure. Well, definitely, you know, dead and dying trees are a huge source of food, particularly for woodpeckers, but also for other species that may also use it as nesting habitat cavities and things like that. So there's a lot of conservation entities like the U.S. Forest Service. Now, when they do sales or salvage cuts, they deliberately try to leave behind a certain amount of what they call snags or wildlife trees. And a lot of these are either imperfect, dying, dead trees that, again, will provide for woodpeckers and provide hollow trees, nesting trees for, you know, cavity trees for birds. So yes, you know, really, if you do sanitize your property, be it your small little suburban lot or larger, if you sanitize, meaning, you know, you go in and cut everything dead or imperfect tree out, you will find that you will have a smaller variety of birds that nest there.
Yeah, it seems to come back to that sort of general idea of diversity begets more diversity, kind of a thing, right?
Sure. And, excuse me. Yeah, I think anytime property owners get into thinking they're improving their property, they can have adverse effects that are not intended consequences. They're unintended consequences. But there's a lot of expertise to ask before you start that process. And just make a few phone calls up to the refuge or to the bird club like ourselves and Toby. We'll try to help people, you know, saying, well, maybe you ought to leave a couple of those trees. And it's a trade-off. And so we see it all the time in resource management, whether it be fish in buffer areas or birds in habitat alteration.
What are, in this specific instance, we talked about beetle kill spruce, which has been a significant problem on the peninsula. And are there other things that are sort of on the radar that people are doing more of that can affect habitat? Like, I mean, that's a great example of a lot of people doing this one activity, killing these beetle kill spruce that has an impact on bird habitat. Are there other activities going on like that?
Well, I mean, any change.
Any activity,
I'm saying any change in, like, you know, changing the structure of a forest, or a lot of times what we have here are, you know, are total, complete, what we call type changes, where someone may say you had a forested area and now you have a pasture or grassland. And, of course, you know, like Ken said, it's a trade-off. Sometimes you lose forest birds, but you may pick up grassland birds and things like that, or open country birds or more generalist species. So it's not necessarily that you lose birds in general per se. Is a lot of times you're trading one suite of birds for another suite of birds sometimes.
Yeah.
The other thing is the National Wildlife Federation has a program, I think it's called Yard Birds or something along that lines, and there's actually on their webpage you can go in and it has a whole list of recommendations you can do to increase bird habitat, or like providing water, I mean, can be something you can do that will really bring birds to your area. The other thing is that we know that I think about 60% of our birds are ground nesters. So just the idea of mowing lawns,
right,
as opposed to leaving it in a natural state with some brush piles.
Some ground cover there,
with some ground cover can make a big difference on the habitat. So like at my yard, I keep half of it or more in natural state. And I know this sounds crazy, but with the old Christmas trees, I make big brush piles.
Sure.
So rather than taking them to the dump or burning them, I just take them out into the woods and I pile them up.
Yeah. And, hey, get you out of that one extra mow a year, right?
That's true.
Couldn't let that one go. Sorry, Ken. If you want to get in on the conversation, 690-1687. Again, 690-1687. I want to get back and play a few more sounds. You know, when I was downloading these sounds, I had my sweet little dog with me, and she was quite interested in what I was listening to this morning as I was listening to all these birds. She was very attentive just at that moment. Doesn't always happen that way. Here's another one. This is one maybe we don't hear quite as often.
I mean, that approximates a couple different calls. When I say a couple, like there's ruby crown kinglet that does a call that goes like jit-it, jit-it. And then there's also Wilson's warbly, which sounds similar. Sometimes they do a chimp chimp. So those were calls, which are a little more general than, like generally speaking, when we do breeding bird surveys, we're going by their nuptial songs, generally speaking, because they're so different.
Okay.
And they carry further and a little more distinctive. Not that we don't take in calls, but sometimes there's a little more overlap in calls because they're not always quite as distinctive.
Well, that was a ruby crown kinglet, and that tells you exactly what's going on, because I'm a total amateur at this, and I found a great resource. The Cornell Ornithology Lab has a fantastic library of bird sounds online, and me not knowing the difference between a call and some of the other styles of vocalizing the birds do, it makes it difficult. You're listening for different things all the time, right?
Yeah, I want to comment on the calls, because up to 2 years ago, I had a hearing problem, and then I got hearing aids. So I'm relearning everything. So there's some tricks to the trade, and people shouldn't get afraid of calls. Because the one thing it does, even if you don't know the call, if you hear the birds and key on the calls, you can focus in where to look. So that's number one right there. It's just being aware of what's around you. But the other thing is that the Cornell Lab has a learning course on how to learn calls. And one of the tricks that they said, and it was a good one, was take one bird and listen to it 20 or 30 times, you know, just like you're playing it here, and focus on that bird and learn that call. And the analogy they gave was that as humans, we're really good on face recognition.
Right.
Right? But if I look at you and I focus on your face, I'm going to get it into my long-term memory. If I go into a room of 100 people and you're standing there, you're just a blur, right? So don't try to learn all the calls at one time. Pick the common ones like the robin and learn it well, and then go on to the next one. And actually around here, if you know 30 to 40 calls, you're going to have a great time in the woods finding these birds, because that's what you're going to see. That's what we have when you're walking through the woods. The other thing is, the other night I was out at midnight, and it was dark, and the robins and the birds were singing like crazy, and it was calm, and you could hear really well. So you could now see all the interaction that was going on in the woods, not just focusing on trying to identify this bird, but you could actually hear the interaction that was happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And it looks like we've got another call coming in. Good morning. You're on the conversation. Who's this?
Well, good morning. My name is Sally, and I'm from Clam Gulch. And I was listening to the comments about the pheasants being down in Homer, and of course I've seen some pheasants up in our area as well. But another question I had, it's a little argument my husband and I have had. Neither one of us know anything about birds. What about the turkeys? I've seen turkeys here, and I'm from Montana, and we do have wild turkeys in Montana, but what about up here?
Great question. I have not seen turkeys. Toby, have you seen turkeys?
Yeah. Again, it's similar to what Ken said. You know, they're not indigenous here. They've been released. You know how it is. You can go to your local feed store and you can order them. And just to touch back on the pheasants, is the talking to some of the longtime ornithologists down there in Homer, back the pheasant population, at least the breeding population, probably originates back there to the 1980s, where they actually found that. See, even up here, you know, you'll occasionally see pheasants, but a lot of them are either, like I said, they've escaped either from hunters training their dogs and things like that, and they haven't persisted. Down there, they have persisted. They persisted in areas really where there's, you know, human habitation. I mean, I actually see them going to feeders and feeding underneath feeders. And, you know, as you move out to the truly wild areas, they don't persist. So it's usually where there's been some type of modification by man. And as far as the turkeys, I've seen turkeys up here. I've even seen turkeys with broods of young.
Oh, wow.
So, but I still believe those are birds that recently escaped, maybe just a little bit before spring, nested, produced a brood. And again, usually they will not persist. Usually they'll get killed off by lynx and coyotes, raptors, and things like that.
There's a lot in Alaska that turkeys in the Midwest and other places probably don't usually have to worry about quite as much, in addition to hunters. Well, Sally, thank you so much for that call. Certainly do appreciate it. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation, 690-1687 is the number. Again, 690 1-6-8-7. And as we get to the bottom of the hour here, I think we'll take just a real short break. I'm going to get a little bit more coffee. Hope you'll do the same and join us back here in just a few moments. This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. And we are back. Thank you so much for joining us here on the coffee table on KDLL this morning. We're talking about the Kenai Birding Festival. A lot of fun stuff going on. It's kicking off this week. A lot of the big events coming up over the next few days and continuing through the weekend. We've got Ken Tarbox and Toby Burke are in the studio with us to talk about all this fun stuff. And even pheasants and turkeys. And there's just no limit, it seems, to how much fun we can have with birds on the Kenai Peninsula. And Ken, you mentioned something earlier when we were speaking before the show, and I'll get to it in just a second because we've got another caller on the line. Good morning, you're on the conversation. Who's this?
Yes, my name is Sheila, and I live in Kusilov, Alaska.
Morning, Sheila.
I have seen pheasants that are propagating in the area, and I know which coop they got loose from.
Uh-oh.
And also, I just wanted to mention that seagulls are migratory birds, which we as fishermen in the area, and that hasn't been mentioned about migratory birds, that seagulls are.
Yeah, good point, Sheila, and thank you so much for that call, and I think I know for myself personally, it's easy, especially in the summertime, it seems like all of a sudden the gulls are there, and they're in the parking lot at Safeway and Kenai circling around looking for lunch, and then all of a sudden they're gone. What's the season like for those? And I guess, are there other birds that we sort that it seems like there are a lot of species that we recognize. And, you know, when the sandhill cranes come through, that's sort of a big event, but what are some that maybe fly under the radar a little bit when they come back?
Deal with that. First off on the gulls, population, and Toby gave my age away there a little while ago, but, when I first got here in the mid-70s and 80s, you know, the gull population on the Kenai Flats was numbering in the 5,000 or 6,000. Now, at the end of the season, we've got 30,000, okay? And so we've seen a dramatic increase. And the caller is correct. They do migrate out. This year, on March 30th, we were down in the flats. Toby does a count down there, too. And there was a couple hundred glaucous-winged gulls. A couple days later, there was 1,000. Within a week, there was 5,000 or 10,000. So they all come in a really short time period. And, of course, they'll leave at the end of the summer. I think we have about 70 species that are what we call resident species that stay through the winter. But we all have almost 300 species on the peninsula that we've documented that have the others are migrating through. And, of course, they're migrating because they can't survive the winter, and it's food-related and temperature-related. So the caller is correct. A few years back, we had an event over at the Kenai Chamber of Commerce for the summer, an art show, and we called it Intersecting Journeys. And the reason we did that is because we have fish going out, tourists coming in, birds migrating through, and everything's intersecting here as they're moving. So movement is a major part of our area here in terms of wildlife.
Yeah, it seems like this is such a dynamic area, both in terms of wildlife and in terms of what we have going on as humans. There's so much going on, and that was something that I wanted to spend a little bit of time with this morning too. Is when you're out giving these tours and these talks, are people curious about development here on the Kenai? Because as you mentioned earlier, this is what I was trying to get to before Sheila called. And again, thanks for that call, and thanks for everyone who's called in so far. 690-1687 is the number if you'd like to jump in on the conversation. You mentioned the idea that in a lot of places, there's a bit more infrastructure. There's a bit more just structure in general. There are established trails and more guide services and things like that, and that lends itself, the fact that we don't have so many of those things here on the Kenai, it lends itself to kind of that wild sense of still being able to see things sort of in their natural state. But do you get questions or concerns from folks from other places about how development is affecting these things or has a potential to affect the ability to do this stuff in the future?
Oh, I definitely, when it comes to, bird populations, like most things, are dynamic, especially living things. And one of the things we deal with here when it comes to changes in bird populations, a lot of times we're talking about, a changing climate, and things have been changing since since this area was, you know, people forget it wasn't that long ago that this whole area was glaciated.
Right.
So things have been in constant flux. So we are always having change in climate, change in vegetation in response to climate. And then, of course, we have urbanization. And I know a lot of people who grew up here, they still think in terms of this area being completely rural. And I don't know if that's the way to necessarily characterize this area anywhere as completely rural. Our area is slowly becoming urbanized. And with urbanization, there's definitely changes in bird populations and what thrives here and what doesn't thrive in an urbanized or you know, a modified habitat, you know.
Yeah, and Toby kind of opened this can of worms, Ken. So I'll ask you, going back in the years that you've been here, are there things that you can, I don't want to say one thing caused the other, but are there correlations between that development and things that we see in our observations of wildlife?
Well, you know, that's tough.
That's a big question, yeah.
Because what happens is populations are decreasing, and a lot of these birds are migratory, you know, picking one factor. But the general issue is habitat alteration by humans. I mean, we can point to a number of bird species where that happens. And of course, we've got those habitats that are unique and critical to these migrations. And one area we know that's in that category is estuarine areas. So if you look at the east side of the Kenai Peninsula, the west side of the Kenai Peninsula, the Kenai River mouth, the Kasiluf River mouth are unique. And they're classified as by the National Audubon Society as continental important bird areas because of that uniqueness and service they provide. These migratory birds, the reason we have a lot of our observations and the viewing platform down in the Kenai Flats is because we can observe this migration and use pattern, and these thousands and thousands of birds are coming through. Not only are there 20 to 30,000 gulls on the Kenai Flat that are actually breeding, what we have is we have tens and thousands of shorebirds that are migrating through and waterfowl. And the waterfowl came through in April, and I think anybody that was down there this year could see that. At one point, I was down on the flats and along the riverbank, I counted over 5,000 pintails that were moving through. So, and that was just in a day. And then the next couple of days, they're gone. They're moving north and another group's coming in.
Yeah.
So those are critical areas, and those should receive greater protection and concern. But the other thing is that population is growing. I mean, we went from 10,000 when I moved here to 50,000. There's cost of that. So people, when they're, if you look at the road system that's developed, alteration of drainage patterns, clear cutting. I mean, you just drive down Key Beach, it seems that people want to clear cut their lots without leaving any trees. Well, that's going to cause an impact to those areas. Well, it might not look big for an acre or two on your property, but you go from 10,000 to 50,000 people, and you've got thousands of acres that are being impacted.
On the aggregate. And it looks like we've got another caller on the line. Good morning. Welcome to the conversation. Who's this?
Yeah, hi. Is this, I'm on?
You are on.
Oh, okay. Hey, my name is Walter. I live over on Bridge Access Road, overlooking all the mudflats. I grew up over there, and our family moved there in 65. So anyway, I've been pretty active on the mudflats as I grew up as a kid, and I learned how to shoot shotgun over there. And, you know, we're talking about, I was listening, you're talking about the gull population and how it's increased. And I remember when there wasn't really a seagull on the mudflats when I was young. And as the years have progressed along, the sedimentation, I think, is one of the big factors over there that's helped that, you know, the filling of muds. And as it develops every year, thaw, freeze. And it's become unbelievable working over there for seagull habitat, obviously, when you go and look at it. One of the things that we really enjoy in an off sense is the fact that in the spring, the eagles show up and, you know, they feed considerably on the incoming seagulls at first. It's one of their first food sources over there. And but anyway, we've watched it for years, and it's been an amazing, you know, change in sight and what we have over there. And in our flats is kind of an unsung, I think, a high spot for our area, really. So it's good to hear everybody talking about it.
Well, thank you so much for that call, and that kind of gets back or continues with what we were talking about in this idea that there's more infrastructure, there are a lot more people here than there used to be even just a couple of short decades ago, and all these things have to be considered or maybe should be considered when new developments pop up. And I'm curious, you know, what's on the radar? What are things, you know, the Kenai Flats and that whole estuary system, I'm sure is one spot on the peninsula that is very much sort of in focus for folks who are of a conservation mindset. Where are some other areas that might have or might see more dramatic impact if development were to come that way?
Well, I mean, as far as going back to the estuaries, whether, like I said, whether you're talking about, you know, the mouth of the Anchor River, or like I said, Deep Creek, or whether it's the Kasiloff, whether it's the Kenai, whether it's Bishop Creek or Otter Creek, it's all those estuaries are essentially like little oases. And some of them are big oases, like the Kenai Flats or the Kasiloff Flats. But again, you know, they're incredibly productive areas. And the thing is, it's really, most people would not intuitively recognize them as incredibly productive, because a lot of times they say, look, it's barren, it's flat, there's little or no timber, it just gets flooded every once in a while, it's just grassland, it's wasteland. But again, when we go back and we look at, like, biologically speaking, the areas that produce the greatest amount of biomass, we're talking about tropical rainforests, coral reefs, and estuaries. And those estuaries, whether it's you're focusing on bird life, whether you're talking about small benthic organisms or fishes, you know, it's a powerhouse of biomass, of food, be it for us, be it for wildlife, and for us to, you know, kind of, again, just, you know, like I said, if we act intuitively and say, oh, these look barren, why don't we just fill them in? I mean, you know, a lot of times, like Mud Bay, I don't know if people are familiar with Mud Bay there at the base of the Homer Spit, you know.
We
witnessed, you know, this incredible sight, you know, the past week, you know, we saw 150,000 or more shorebirds come in. And, you know, in the recent past, they talked about filling that small bay in with gravel and making it a big parking area. And I guess what we're saying is that, you know, a lot of times we have these unintended consequences. People are not intending to reduce, you know, the productivity of an area, but a lot of times they do it, but, you know, without intending to do it.
Yeah.
And we have to take that into consideration, because, like I said, we have these really, really productive areas, and people say, well, if I just take this part, and we're watching some of these really productive areas being nibbled away at the edges, and the overall productivity of the area being reduced. And then, you know, over time, like I said, it's incremental, but over the course of generations or even someone's lifetime, they say, you know, it used to be like this and it's not like that anymore, and I don't know why, because the change is being incremental. But a lot of times you can find out why the productivity has been reduced.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ken.
Well, one area you asked about other than just the estuaries is the riparian zones along all of our streams.
Right.
These are highly productive areas. And, of course, in the past here, the borough has put in a 50-foot buffer on a lot of the stream systems. But the conversation about that really revolved around salmon production, right? Anadromous fish. And it really did not get into the fact that these riparian zones are critical for some of these birds feeding along these zones. Again, these are highly productive areas on these riparian zones. You have the interaction. Whenever you have an edge effect like that, you get better diversity and productivity. So I guess the other area to look at is the borough is looking at a new mayor coming up and assembly as to whether or not those 50-foot zones are going to be maintained or not.
And that's a topic that you and I have discussed in the past, and we've spent some time on the KDLL airwaves talking about those anadromous streams and all those sorts of things. But something you mentioned earlier in talking about, you know, when you're out guiding folks around, is this idea of kind of a more holistic system, the idea that all these things are sort of attached together. And I was hoping you could expand on that a little bit. I mean, and especially thinking about something that comes to mind is some different fishing regulations for dip netting season and some areas along the Kenai River that are now closed to access for dip netting. And it seems like there's some positive reception to the idea that we need to mind these spaces a little more closely and not, here's a phrase that's used a lot, and not love them to death.
That's true. Actually, the concept of these zones goes back over hundreds of years. In fact, the Columbia River, over 100 years ago, a salmon biologist said we ought to have large sections of this river where we have no development. And they called them salmon sanctuaries because fish were rearing near the banks. The same concept is being discussed today in different areas because if you look at a system like the Kenai River, the lots are very expensive and they're right next to each other on all the private land right up until the boundary of the Fish and Wildlife Service land or the Forest Service land. So here we do have a sanctuary in the sense of the federal government, and that's also a sanctuary for birds and other things. And that's what we're talking about in this holistic sense, is that you just don't want to be single species oriented when you look at something. The scientific community is evolving that way too. I mean, fish and game agencies historically, and still are in a lot of places, single species oriented. It's moose, it's caribou, it's salmon, right?
Yeah.
But there is a movement in academia and some other state agencies to look at an ecosystem approach in terms of management. And that research and science is being developed as we speak.
And we think about, you said a lot of times we can be very focused on this species or that species. There's a lot of specialization in the research that's done, in the field work that's conducted, all those sorts of things. When you're talking about taking a more broad-based approach, does it change sort of the expertise that's needed to collect data and make decisions and develop policy and that sort of thing?
Sure. It's a whole different field.
Whole different ballgame.
It's a whole different ballgame. And the other thing that's happening is that in any resource management field, you have uncertainty in your data. So as you start going out from a single species and saying, well, I understand sockeye salmon in Skelak Lake, right? But now you're trying to figure out how sockeye salmon interact with everything else in the system. You get more and more uncertainty in your data. And unfortunately, in our system, uncertainty is looked at as a negative. And therefore, people say, well, it's up to a resource agency to prove harm. And of course, on a national level, with the National Environmental Policy Act, the applicant has to prove no harm. So we have a different in philosophy in a lot of the states, especially in Western states, that come to how we deal with resource questions.
It's really interesting being in a Western state with all these different agencies that kind of have their hand in how things are done and why they're done and how long it takes and all that sort of thing. We've got about 10 minutes here left on the program. If you'd like to get in on the conversation in our closing moments, 690-1687 is the number. We're joined with Ken Tarbox and Toby Burke this morning talking about the Kenai Birding Festival and all things bird and nature and conservation and really having a great time this morning. I wanted to get back to, I have a few more bird sounds. And one, I was looking, there's the Kenai Birding Festival also has a page on Facebook. If you're a social media person, you can get great information there as well. And I believe this is where I saw it. I think somebody posted that they had seen a short-eared owl somewhere near, and I wanted to give that one a listen real quick here. So that's kind of a fun one, right? I mean, owls, are there a lot of owls here? Do we see them a lot? Are they tough to get?
Are you saying owls in general? General
owls in general, but this is a short-eared owl that apparently is out and about in the area right now.
Yeah, they're an open. The short-eared owl is an open country, basically diurnal owl, and they love the flats. They love the open areas. Can they be hard to find? I think you do need some patience because you have to scan. But, like I said, if you go down to Bridge Access Road or the Wildlife Viewing Platform and you just spend time scanning, a lot of times they'll be perched on some of the stump wads or anything, a small tree. But they are out there. They breed. I mean, they're expected out there. But maybe, 50% or more, you'll probably fail to find one. Especially the evenings and or the early morning, you're more likely to find them. But when you're saying owls in general on the Kenai Peninsula, most species are relatively abundant.
Okay.
But sometimes they're seldom seen. And a lot of times if people aren't paying attention, you don't hear that calling great horned owl with traffic going by in the evening.
Yeah.
One of the best places to owl, and we did it in March, end of March, was out Swanson River Road, and you drive all the way out to the end of the road there, and we had boreal saw-whet and great horned owls out there calling. Of course, we're out there at midnight, and there's a little funny story. We were driving out there, and a police officer stopped our vehicle, and on the way out, and he said, where are you headed? And we said, we're going owling. I'm not sure he believed us, but we really were. And we had them all out there. So you hear them calling, and it's really fun. You got to dress warm. The end of March is cold.
Oh, sure.
But Swanson River Road is a great spot, and the road is maintained, so you don't have to worry about, you know, breakdowns. But you're out there by yourself in the middle of the night, but it is a great experience.
And if the cops stop you, you got a good out now.
You got a good out, yeah.
That's great. Talking about being out at sort of odd hours, you know, if you want to see some of these species, you have to be out and about when they're out and about. And that, I would be remiss if I didn't take a few moments to talk about the 24-hour big sit. That's a super fun part of the Kenai Birding Festival, and it's something that people do all over the country. Tell me a little bit about the 24-hour big sit, where folks are going to be stationed, and some of the birds that they're going to be on the lookout for.
Yeah, well, our 24-hour big sit event will be, as it always is, this will be the fifth year. It'll be at the wildlife viewing platform there at the Port of Kenai, right off of Boat Launch Road. So we'll be there from 6 a.m. Saturday morning until 6 a.m. Sunday morning. So it'll be round the clock, 24 hours a day. These 24-hour big sits, they do occur in other parts of the country in Canada. But I don't think there are very many, or we're the only one really that occurs this far north at this latitude. And in many ways, I'm kind of amazed that there haven't been more in Alaska, because we get to have essentially a 24 big sit without a true night. You know, we still have light. It's just more twilight. So I'm kind of amazed that there haven't been more of these up in Alaska. But as far as I know, we're the only one that occurs annually up here. And a lot of these big sits that have occurred in Alaska have been for 6 hours or 8 hours. But this is 24 hours.
Yeah, and we've got time for one more call. We'll go back to the phones right now. Welcome to the conversation. Good morning. Who's this?
Yeah, hi, this is Ron Levy. I've been here a long time. And I had a question about some bald eagle nests that are pretty easy to see. They're right by the road on the way to Homer, of course, near mile 145 or so, and then the one, I think, right off the bridge access. And I'm just curious if there's a danger of people if we walk up to the trees, or how sensitive that might be, either while they're bringing up their young or other times. They're just off enough to where they're probably not bothered by people, but especially this time of year, is there any danger in walking up to them there?
Well, as far as these nests concerned, it really varies depending on the pair. You know, we have some birds that are extremely sensitive. They'll leave the nest, or they even may try to attack you. But there's other birds where they're accustomed. They've been conditioned to the activity, especially some of these ones that are near busy places like roads or even airports and things like that. So some of these birds, and one thing I think Ken's really familiar with, you know, there's a, generally speaking, you know, like trumpeter swans are known to not like, you know, float plane traffic. But, you know, there's an exception to the rule. I mean, if you've ever been down to Homer on Beluga Lake, there is a pair of trumpeter swans.
That's right.
Are incredibly tolerant of that high traffic area. But again, we're talking about those. These are exceptions to the norm. You know, this is probably a pair that's been nesting there for their long-lived birds for many years. And most like trumpeter swans, they will bypass that area and say, we don't want any part of this lake. It's too noisy. It's not a good place to rear young. But this
takes a tough pair to.
Yeah. So, and there are eagles like that too, where they come back to the same nest and they've been conditioned to of course, they've been successful, meaning that people generally have left them alone.
Right.
If they were bothered, to a certain extent where they felt, you know, that their brood was jeopardized, then they wouldn't come back. So I think there's something to be learned there, that some of these species can tolerate some development, but really, again, if they're left alone, you know, their space, they may have a smaller space, but you still don't want to violate that.
Yeah. Ken?
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. As a general rule, while the bird's incubating the eggs, you know, their chances of abandoning the nest increases because they're not vested in the young. But after the eggs hatch and they've actually invested in the young, then, you know, their tolerance may go up a little bit. But it's the rule of thumb of number of interactions, too. I mean, one person walking out to a nest is not the same as 500 walking out to a nest. And so there's thresholds that, you know, they may be able to tolerate one or two visits over the nesting season. But if all of a sudden you get a lot of interaction, and it's the same way, I want to go back to the bird calls. There's a number of refuges that don't allow bird calls because there's too many people playing the call to attract birds.
And yeah.
So it's a common sense decision, really, as to what the level of interaction is with those areas. As a general rule, it's best to kind of leave them alone and stay your distance.
Stay your distance and just enjoy the view and enjoy observing them in their natural state. And that's for, I know for myself, it's so much fun when you get out someplace and you're able to just see whatever the animal, be it a bird or sheep on the side of a hill, whatever it is, just to watch them kind of do their thing for a while is always a lot of fun. We've got just a couple of minutes left, and what I wanted to do to kind of wrap up is ask both of you who have spent a lot of time out in the woods, what's your, I don't know if either of you are life listers or anything like that, but just real quickly, the species that you were most excited to see or most surprised to see, if you have a quick version of that story. Toby?
Hmm.
Oh, so many choices.
No, yeah, exactly. You know, I've gotten more focused on the Kenai Peninsula just because I don't do a lot of traveling. So, you know, we do most of our birding in our backyard. And when I say our backyard, we think of the Kenai Peninsula as our backyard. So I guess, you know, I think of my fondest experiences bird watching being on the Kenai Peninsula, but really being off the beaten path. And so I can't say any of the birds, like, for example, our family likes to go camping and hiking and bird watching up in the Alpine. And, you know, the diversity up there is very low. It's a really austere habitat, but we seldom, you know, most people don't live in that habitat. So when we go up there, everything's really novel. We go up there, we found nesting wandering tattlers. It's a shorebird that nests high up in the Alpine. So those are the things that you know, give me great pleasure, and or I hearken back to. It wasn't necessarily a really rare bird as much as us getting into a habitat that we seldom go to usually.
Yeah, just the experience. How about you, Ken?
Well, I know this is going to sound strange, but I actually started off as a waterfowl hunter and still do. And so waterfowl got my initial interest in birding and how to learn their identification and habitat. But then you migrate or evolve, I guess, as an individual and got into birding. And I had what we call nemesis birds. These are birds that you try to find and you can never find them. And I had a mine was a greater roadrunner, and I went to Arizona for 10 days and never saw a roadrunner, and everybody said, you're nuts to miss a roadrunner. So I had to make a second trip. So, but the bird that really caught my attention in terms of listing was red-breasted mergansers that we have here. They're just a beautiful male bird. It's just an awesome bird. And so that kind of started us down that path.
Yeah. Well, Ken and Toby, thank you so much. We have just a few quick seconds left, but thank you guys so much for being with us today. The Kenai Birding Festival going on through the weekend, kenaipeninsula.org for all the information. Thanks for tuning in.